Chris Pearson. I'm an author of such novels as the Talatis trilogy for Dragonlance and a number of short stories for DAW. I'm also one of the co-editors of Stalking the Wild Hare, which is the anthology that came out for Gen Con specifically, consisting of stories by all of the authors that you will find here this weekend. It will be available on Amazon, but there are also some of the authors are selling it here. So if you're interested, seek them out.
I'm Paul Jeunesse. I'm author of the Iron Dragon series, which is set in a fairly unique world. So I really like talking about setting and world building and stuff like that. Authored about a dozen short stories and novel series, working on other stuff. So it should be a fun panel.
My name is Bob Farnsworth, or Robert Farnsworth. I got a short story finally. I have been writing game material events for tournaments and stuff like that for Gen Con for like 20 years. And then I stopped and I started writing fiction. So I've done any kind of setting you can think of.
My name is Maurice Broaddus. I've published a lot of short stories in horror, fantasy, sci-fi. I'm the editor for the Dark Fate anthology through Apex Books. I have a novel series called The Knights of Breton Court. And it's the King Arthur legend, and its setting is modern-day Indianapolis.
Convenient.
Yeah.
My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City, where I teach courses in fantasy fiction and creative writing, among others. I am also an author, increasingly an author. My first novel was a work of epic fantasy called The Third Sign, which came out last year from Gale Cengage, and that was just actually optioned for a film within the last month, so that's cool. Thanks. So that's that. My second novel is currently being looked at by publishers while I work on my third. I also am co-editing an anthology of speculative fiction and politics, which will include such notables as Paul Jeunesse, among others, along with Joe Haldeman and a bunch of others, so we're excited about that. And the other thing I wanted to mention was, that since this has been brought up in other panels as well, is that we have readings and signings that we're doing throughout the weekend. In fact, Chris and I have one later on today that we'll be doing a reading, so we would love to see you all there if you can come.
We've got a reading tomorrow.
Oh, I'm sorry, tomorrow. Sorry. Right, my fault. It all blurs together. Sometime you will see us.
So I guess I'll start out by asking the panel if there's any particular scene in a book not written by you that has really struck you lately.
Lately?
If that makes it difficult, just in general.
I'll pass.
Okay.
Not lately.
I'll have to pass because every single book I read seems to have something. So.
Okay.
Does anyone got something?
It's way too much.
Anyone?
I read too much.
That one thing.
That has a particular.
All right, I got.
Something
right,
that stands
out. The drowned world. Just spaced his name. Gone. Drowned worlds. Anyway, the setting is this jungle planet, very unlike Avatar actually, with giant trees and the whole forest is flooded, and I can't think of the author's name right now. And it was so interesting because everything is so wet, like all of the time. And there's these three different. There's an insectoid race that lives there, and the humans came in. There's pig aliens who live there. It was. So fascinating because he really did the science on it a little bit and created all these monsters and animals. And I'm thinking James Cameron was like reading it before he did Avatar. I'm thinking he would, it was called Drowned World. And it was really good.
I'll play off of that. There's a I taught last year. It's not super recent, but it's on my mind because I taught it relatively recently. James Patrick Kelly's *Burn*, which won the Hugo Award last year, is a world set. The planet is called Walden, and it is deliberately and intentionally being reforested by a group of people who want to live in an idyllic world similar to Thoreau's world, Walden. The problem is that they are facing this group of people that are burning these forests down because it wasn't a forested planet. They're making it into one against the natives' will. So it's sort of a reverse, you know, we're not tearing down the forest, we're forcibly causing you to have to live in one, which I think is an interesting change on the usual setting. Sort of like if the Marines came to Avatar's world and were like, you will live in a great tree and you will be one with the earth. And no, you know, if that was the story, that's essentially kind of what this is. So I found it a very unusual setting, kind of in reverse as well. So.
Yeah, I read a lot of crime fiction. So for me, reading like George Pelicanos and just him just exploring, you know, the Washington, D.C. area and just how it can, how the city itself almost becomes a character in the novel has just been something that's always fascinated me as a reader and a writer.
Mm-hmm. The Hal Clement Gravity's book, I can't remember what it was now. The Heavy Worlds.
Mission of Gravity.
Mission of Gravity. That was really impressive because it's like, whoa, I just feel like we're really heavy. And it's like, I was just reading the book and going like, yeah, I could picture that.
And there's one that I'm reading at the moment called Under Heaven by Guy Gabriel Kay, where he manages to take just small details and somehow paint an entire feel for a scene. Like he talks, one of the recurring images in the book is of the lead character's father's home. And when the lead character grew up, he talks about how the Polonia leaves would all fall in one day and cover everything, and that was autumn for him, was that one day when all the leaves fell.
That's a fantasy China, right?
That's a fantasy China.
Yeah. Ballard is a KG Ballard. This is a drowned world.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll ask what people on the panel, like,
right,
when you're trying to evoke setting, what do you try to do to really bring your characters and your readers into the reading, so they need to really evoke the setting? What are your tricks?
Well, for me, like, I'm a huge study of geography and planetary geography, and I was inspired by Mars and Olympus Mons on Mars, this just huge shield volcano that is 500 miles in diameter, so it's the size of the state of Arizona, and it's 65,000 feet tall. And if you stood on it and there was an atmosphere on Mars with clouds, the clouds would definitely be below most of Olympus Mons. So if you
the
stood
atmosphere
on,
would be below it, too.
The atmosphere would be below Olympus Mons. Right? So if you stand on the edge, you'd just be looking down at the clouds, and that was my inspiration. So my world is these huge plateaus, and nobody knows what's down below the clouds. They stand on the edge of the cliff and they look down. And there's a great sense of superstition and lore. And what they do know is that demons and griffins and all sorts of nasty things fly up and out of this mist and just harass the people who live on the plateaus, who have to hide either underground or under trees. And immediately, it's a dangerous, very, very dangerous place. They don't go out and cover without taking great precautions. And immediately, right away, I established the dangerous world, and that was the tone of my book. You know, it helps me keep the tension up all the time. And then there's the mystery element, because everybody's like, well, what's below these clouds? And, you know, it's the plateaus are not, you know, floating on a layer of marshmallows. You know, like, it's not silly fantasy. I don't mean to impugn floating castles or whatever, you know, on clouds, but it's not that. It's realistic. You know, the forest is realistic, and it's harsh. And if you've ever tried to just walk through any woods, it's not very easy. It's very difficult. And if the world is trying to kill you, it just keeps the tension going all the time. So that's kind of my trick in the Iron Dragon series.
I've written Japanese fantasy, Victorian fantasy, and I really try to either watch films or research. I travel a lot for work, so I get a chance to travel to some of the places I write about. which is hard for most people, but just walking down to some place near you that's close to the setting that you're trying to evoke is probably gives you a good way to think of things, like going into a market, the crowded people and stuff like that. That always helps. If you feel like you need to write something about a crowd of people in a market, go to the local mall. Avoid all the people. You know, all that sort of stuff. It's useful.
Yeah, I actually got in a blog argument about setting because, again, people were very possessive about the King Arthur or King Arthur legend. So the fact that I had taken it and put it in Indianapolis really upset some people. And they were like, well, what's Indianapolis? Like, I can't even find Indianapolis on a map. and so that was their big issue with it.
Fortunately, all of you could.
So, right. And my point in discussing this with him was, you know, all setting is a blank canvas until I make it real for you, as the writer, until we make it real for you. And so for me, I just happen to know Indianapolis. So I'm writing what I know. And so, like some of the book takes place not too far from here, but you guys aren't going to know this part of Indianapolis because I crawl, you know, I work a lot with a homeless teen ministry. So there's a lot of times when we're crawling under the bridges that are around here, and that's where some of the kids live. And so, you know, even natives of Indianapolis don't look at Indianapolis that way. And yeah. Like, so there's this whole other side of Indianapolis that people just don't know about. And so that's the Indianapolis I decided to write about. And so I'm, you know, building on this world, one, that no one knows about. And then two, you know, I do know this world. So I'm sucking everybody into this new world, and this new way of looking at just their own city.
Yeah, that's one thing most people don't do is they don't go to the seedy part of town.
Right.
Yeah, they kind of avoid that. They go, oh, we don't go past that street. Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things about what you just said, which I think is important, and Paul touched on this too, is the idea that most of us, I think, as writers, start with some kind of real-world inspiration. We start with having been in the midst of this forest that moved us, or reading about the place on Mars. Or I remember being at one point, I was in Greece, this is about maybe 10 years ago, and I was in an area of Crete where when you come around this one side of the road, the sort of side, this one particular portion of Crete, which is near Hania, a port near Crete, has like a mountain which is very, it's not just sheer, but it's sort of kind of diagonally sloping into the sea, and it because it's happened over, you know, thousands and thousands of years, when the air hits it, it's sort of any kind of spray or mist that you would expect would be coming up from an ocean is sort of dried out by the time it hits you. And so it's almost as if you're walking out from behind tree cover and you've been slapped in the face with hot, dry air. And I remember having that really be distinctive to me and imagining, you know, what it would be like to sort of write about cultures or environments like this. And so one of the things that I've worked on that I refer to obliquely in here and that comes up in later books is the experience of people who travel to those worlds, travel to, let's say, this desert area of the nation of Clun, which this is about, and the experience of opening their tent flap. You know, they get there, they have been in carts and they've been sort of covered as much as possible. And when they then go out to sort of experience this environment and they open the tent, it's as if they've been slapped in the face with the environment, quite literally, you know, like the environment has said, here you are, and it's in a very different world. So I think a lot of us take that sort of real-world inspiration and fold it into the setting for our books, and the more we can do that, the more that readers will be able to grab onto those things, having experienced similar moments, maybe not the same moment, but similar moments of experiencing something that was very different and distinctive in their setting to them as well. The nice thing is we can then take it, as I'm sure you do, and, you know, extend it in a different ways than what we were inspired by. So you start from a real-world emphasis, but if you stay there, then you're not really ultimately writing fantasy, right? You start with a real-world emphasis, and then your imagination kind of takes it from that point forward. But it's logically emerging from the real-world experience that you had. And I think if you do that, you create a sense of reality so people can believe in the world, but still, it is a fantasy world, and that's why readers are picking up your book in the first place.
One of the things that I try to do when I'm establishing setting is remember the other senses beyond sight. It's very easy to, particularly if you're doing your research online and you're looking around and you're looking on doing Google image searches to get specific setting inspirations. And Google image search is great for that if you want to look up If you look up mountains on Google image search, you'll get a huge variety of stuff that you can that you can pick and choose from. But you don't get the other senses. You don't get what the rushing of the wind sounds like. You don't get that slap of hot, dry air in your face. You don't get the smells that you get.
You don't get the shortness of breath above 8,000 feet.
Exactly. So try when you're establishing a setting, try to hit at least two or three of the other senses. Taste can be difficult, although you can get that particularly if the air is thick enough. You can describe the sour taste it puts in your mouth if you're in a jungle and stuff like that. But if you hit the other senses beyond sight, it's going to be that much more immersive. It's going to be 2, 3, 4 times as immersive because your reader is going to be imagining it on several different dimensions.
And we experience the world that way too. I mean, we experience the world sometimes not simply through sight, but it's the sound we first hear. It's the feel of the gravel on, you know, below us. It's the, you know, the I mentioned the hot, dry air thing. That's the thing that you first remember. So we don't just always interpret sight first and then everything else. We do a lot of our things through sight, but the other senses are equally important sometimes in how we interpret settings around us. So.
For sort of rural or wilderness settings, it's very easy for us not to imagine that stuff if we live in cities. Because, I mean, if you live in a city, you don't even really get a good view of a night sky, let alone, you know, hearing the sounds of nature and so forth. So try to at some point get, if you live in a city, like I live in Boston and New York and Indianapolis.
Orlando.
Try to get out into the wilderness, or at least into the country now and then, to reestablish what that feels like, particularly if you're writing fantasy, because there's not a lot of light pollution and stuff in most fantasy cities.
Right.
I was in Australia last year for a couple of weeks, and most of Australia is terribly dry. It can be warm dry, cool dry, cold dry, but it's mostly dry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Orlando, Florida. How many people have gone to Florida before? You know, you walk outside and you go, oh, it's so hot, it's so miserable. Well, we're walking around Australia and it's going like, oh, this is nice. We get this breeze that comes along and dries the sweat. We kind of get used to it for a couple of weeks. Then we go to Cairn, Australia for the Barrier Reef. We get off, it's 98 degrees, 95% humidity. And everybody getting off the plane is going like, oh, this is horrible. And my wife and I are going like, oh, this feels like home. There's humidity again. Our skin is just like soaking up this humidity. It's like, oh, we missed it. I couldn't believe it. So, you know, how many times do you look at contrast? Yeah. You go from air conditioning outside, it's 98 degrees. You go, oh, I breathe. It's on my face, it's on my back, it's on my arms, my legs, my feet, all that.
Yeah, I actually have to take off here in a minute, but I got two examples along those lines. One, because you mentioned going into seedier areas, so I'll get back to that in a second, but like one place, one scene in my novel takes place actually only 2 blocks from here. It's just over the Washington Street Bridge on your way to the zoo. But like most people don't get out of their car to go under that bridge. So if you go under that bridge, what happened was is the way the bridge is constructed, there's all these little, I don't even know how you describe it, but there's like these holes underneath the bridge. And what happened is that kids would go into the holes and they would treat, you know, these little areas under the bridge as their own little apartments. So, you know, so a lot of times we're going out with this ministry, I'd go out at night and there's nothing like sticking your head up a hole under a bridge. Mm. Just to see if there's anyone there, and worse, if there is someone there, you know, what kind of greeting you're gonna get? Anyone here? You know. And of course, in the novel, of course, there's a troll under there. But you know,
that's where you extend.
Right.
You extend.
There's several scenes that take place that do take place in a seedier area of town, and so you know, I would go out there and hang out and you know, just get a feel for the place, which, there is a rush when you're, you know, hanging out, even in areas where you think you belong, and then you realize, you know, I don't belong here.
Yeah, a little adrenaline.
Yeah, and in fact, my wife, when she found out where I had been hanging out, is like, yeah, your research is over now. So, you're done researching, or I'm increasing the insurance policy. You know, either way. So yeah, I gotta take off. So.
Thanks. This kind of thing, I think, happens also, you know, much more in modern society where you have the experience of travel. And you can have over, you know, within a day, you can travel from one side of the world to the other. And speaking of the Australia thing is a good example of that. So, you know, you go from Australia, and I remember very distinctly sitting on Bondi Beach, right? And the Pacific Ocean is rolling in, and there's this beautiful weather, and it's all wonderful, and, you know, because this is during
some of the women are topless, and they don't.
See, I wasn't going to bring that up. And
they don't need to be.
Okay. I was referring to other, you know, the setting, other aspects of the thing. So you're on this beach and you're sort of taking it all in, and this is during their summer and our winter. So I get on a plane, and within 22 to 23 hours, I'm touching down in Providence, Rhode Island, in this little prop plane that's going like this because there's wind rushing across the icy step, you know, and I'm just like, well, here I, you know, I'm home, and, you know, getting out of, well, close to home, and getting out of that, you know, walking out of the airport for the first time after literally within a day, you were sitting in this beautiful, warm environment, and now, kablam, you're in this icy, cold experience, you know, feeling. That creates a kind of contrast which is very provocative and powerful as a writer. It could be sometimes unfortunate as a human coming back from vacation, that's, you know. But it's very powerful, and that contrast is something that we have the benefit of that other cultures, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago might not have had the benefit of because they couldn't travel as quickly and get from one place to another and be able to have that kind of contrast within a day, within hours, you know, the way that we do, sort of bridged over by this climate-controlled airplane. So it's like one climate, plane, and then totally different kind of climate on the other end of that. And so that can be, you know, productive when developing setting, although, as I say, not always so good when you're actually traveling, you know, and vacationing as well, yeah.
On the other hand, if you live in New England, you can just go inside for a couple hours and come.
Well, yeah, that's true. I grew up in England. You're right. That's a good point.
I was in Australia, and we landed in Alice Springs. How many people have seen pictures of Alice Springs? It's mostly dry, dusty, hot. We landed. It was 85 degrees and green. And we're going, like, we're in the right place, right? This is Alice Springs. And the first thing we did was we asked the front desk manager at our hotel what's going on. She said, well, we had 17 inches of rain last night, and the river was actually a river. Well, the river that goes through Alice Springs is a dry riverbed. There's bridges going over it, but it's just so that they don't go through it and then get washed out when the water does come. But when the water does come, they said there are actually people wading out in the river, quote unquote, and a couple days later it's gone. But it was, everything was green. So it's like, you know, you can put that into your setting where it's like, oh yeah, it's all been hot and dusty and dry and gray and brown and red. And then all of a sudden, all the green comes up.
I don't know if anyone followed the stories of what happened in Iowa with the, it had been a more or less a man-made, right, sort of lakefront area, that a dam broke. And so within a couple of hours, the lake vanished. And these people were now sitting above, sort of like, you know, looking down, first of all, on whatever water was remaining. And their whole, now they sort of emphasized, you know, the lakefront property they'd paid this money for no longer had the nice view. I wasn't as interested in that. I was, more happy that no one, you know, died in that experience, first of all, is the most important thing. But I think the fact that it was such
on
a radically...
On the other side of the dam, hundreds of homes were wiped out.
Were wiped out entirely. And the experience of... I was just fascinated at the sort of the before and after stuff, where you saw a setting had radically altered, right, you know, literally within a few hours, and how it affected the people that were involved in that. And I think that's one thing that... that Paul, you made reference to with your book, and it's true. In Paul's book, everything is influenced by the world in which they live. Now, that might seem obvious, but a lot of times, if you read some kinds of writing, you'll see writing that sort of talks about these characters as if they're operating entirely in a vacuum and not impacted by the settings in which they live, the worlds in which they're forced to operate or in which they choose to operate and function. And that's, I think, a very important thing as well. The way to make setting really work is to make it important to the characters who live within it and not just sort of like a two-dimensional backdrop, you know, like a blue screen and they're just sort of doing this. There's a reason that they filmed the Lord of the Rings movies in New Zealand. It's because they knew that they could immerse them in something something which would be much closer to that environment than bringing him to Hollywood and throwing him in front of a, you know, blue screen, Lucas, you know. So I think...
Or right.
So I think that's the real key here is trying to develop a setting which matters to the people that live within it and being conscious of that as you're writing. I think that's important too.
What was cool driving through New Zealand was seeing, you're going like, I've been here, and then you realize it's like, oh yeah, this was in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and they love that. They're like, yeah, come see where, you know. Yeah.
But you're going like, this place looks familiar. What?
Yeah.
Familiarity is something that you can that you can really pull from as well. Anything. There, most of the time when you're writing a book, you're going to be writing at least semi through the eyes of a character, and asking yourself what is that character going to notice about the setting. You might not like if the weather's kind of the same as home, but there's there's weird constant frog song going on because that's what the local fauna is. That's what the character is going to notice.
They're not going to notice that the sky is blue, the grass is green.
Right, exactly. And certain things that they experience in the setting may evoke memories or feelings from their own experience, which is great because that gives you an avenue not just into establishing setting. But into establishing character depth as well.
Yep.
There are days, you know, I was joking about New England weather, but it's true that it literally can, particularly in the winter, can be radically different. And there was a day this past February that was just incredibly mild and balmy for no apparent reason whatsoever. And my wife and I walked out of the house, and my wife turned to me and said, "This feels like Jamaica." And that brought back, that was where we went for our honeymoon, so that brought back all kinds of memories. And just basically, like, four words, I think those four words probably evoked some sort of feeling in you just, you know, particularly if you've been to the Caribbean, like, what that feels like. You can achieve this sort of thing with fairly small, spare phrases, and it doesn't have to be giant, flowery, Tolkien-esque, like describing every plant in the old forest, kind of thing. That's great if you're trying to really create this, you know, a setting of lush vegetation, but it's not necessary for every time you're establishing a setting.
And Tolkien was really good, let's just say that, okay? But Fellowship of the Ring, so hard to get through for a lot of people, because he's talking about the damn weather fronts, you know? We go, oh, there's a warm front coming in, and he doesn't, like, he spends a half a page on this. You know, this warm wind, and the leaves are blowing, and it goes on and on and on, and you just want to kill yourself, you know, sometimes when you're reading.
Put me out of my misery.
You're waiting for something
to
happen.
Get out of the Shire.
Please leave the Shire. Everybody's pissed off because they took out the Barrow White scene, because that was, like, the only good thing that happened in the first book, not in the movie, right?
Yep.
You know? And it's like, in your writing, the weather could be critical. If you're Rachel Caine and you're writing the Weather Warden series, which is fantastic, the weather is everything. And these people are like genies. Or they're not genies, but they're people who manipulate genies and magic. And the weather is like so cool, and I'm never going to know the weather again the same way after reading her series. So it's fascinating. But most of the time, please, avoid the damn weather, okay? A little bit, a four-word phrase, a little thing like that, fantastic, but just Don't go too far. I mean,
unless the weather is exceptional, if a thick fog rolls in,
yeah, for no
right. If it's a horrible storm, if like there was one time I was driving and I looked up and the sky was green and I couldn't figure out why the sky was green except over there the sky was purple at the same time.
So it's germane to the story or the plot, but boring stories are too much about the weather for me. I don't know about you guys. Most of the classics, they talk about the weather way too much.
In Florida, when the sky turns green, that's the time you go inside.
Yes. Well,
because it's like tornadoes around. It's really quiet. No birds.
I figured out that book. It's Drowning World by Alan Dean Foster. I'm really sorry, Mr. Foster, that I forgot his name. It's fantastic.
I don't think I see him here.
It's a fantastic.
Yeah. I wanted to mention too. This goes back to the thing about the impact. We talked a little bit about this. We were talking about this in the antagonist panel a little while ago. you're not, when you're writing a novel, you're not writing a source book. That's going to sound obvious, but in some cases, I think that, especially for fantasy, speculative fiction authors, there's so much emphasis and interest in how, check out how cool this world is, and I've got maps upon maps, and you haven't even, and I've got gazeters, and I mean, look, if you're gonna, you should use gazeters with caution, okay? I mean, if you're putting a gazeter in a book, it indicates that there's a lot of stuff that you've got to
gazeter.
No, I think
gazeter.
Yeah,
fascinating.
I always
gazette.
Heard gazeter.
Gazette.
Okay, you see, this is why you avoid these, because this is what happens. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, anyway. I know. It must be, I don't know.
TV people say gazetteer.
See, the point being.
Just pronounce it almanac.
Just pronounce it. So the point being that as you're going through these kinds of worlds, if they're not being done in service of the story, if the setting is not being done in service of what you're trying to communicate through the story, then it doesn't need to be there. Even at the times when you have developed this world and spent a lot of time on the world, not all of that can or should show up in the book that you're presenting to a reader.
Yeah.
They will get it through osmosis, if nothing else, things that the characters say that they understand. It will show up in your writing over time if you've done the legwork. You do need to do the legwork initially, but you're not writing a source book. And so, as Paul says, to focus upon weather patterns and all these other things, I'm going to disagree with him a little bit in that I think the Fellowship of the Ring spends so much time on it because it's trying to establish what they're fighting for. The reason they're fighting is because they want to save the Shire, and that's why they contrast it with Mordor, and that's why it matters that you're going out to fight this fight, is because of this idyllic setting from which they live. But I agree that there is a lot of emphasis on warm fronts and the like in there, and that's a problem because, again, one wonders if it's in service of the story. So that's the key thing. If it's disconnected and you end up just thinking, you know, I need to write this index so I can, you know, show this to people so they can use it for a role-playing series, that's not, again, the point of why you're writing what you're writing. You're writing about characters in this spectacular environment. You're not doing it to show how many cool mountain ranges you can name within the pages of your book.
It's flavor.
Yeah.
It's all flavor.
Yeah, exactly.
How much different is that, though, if you're writing like a series of books or a trilogy and it's the first one?
The thing is, though, that it shouldn't all, shouldn't all be coming out in the first one. It's the kind of thing that is developed over time. So it's not the kind of thing that, you know, if you're trying to present this magical world, first of all, the point of view characters are not going to be thinking, I live in such a, you know, if they lived in it 20 years, they're not going to think, it's such a magical world. Every time I get up, it's a magical world, right? You know, Bob didn't go out of his house in Florida and think to himself, ah, the humidity is so wonderful all the time, right? He thought about it when it was contrasted with where he had been. So I think you express those things over the course of a trilogy. That's the benefit of having it. You have more time to sort of bring some of those things up. But just as you wouldn't, when introducing a character, show every possible thing you could ever say about the character, because that's not how human beings interact with each other. They remember a couple of key details, and then as they get to know them better, they fill in the gaps. They learn more about them. I think that's the same thing for environment as well.
And also, Tim Maurice writes about Indianapolis. If there's something said in this room, there's no reason to describe everything in Indianapolis. And then inside this room, they're going like, well, why did you tell us all about Indianapolis and every place else if it's all in this room?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
What we're kind of talking about is the info dump, the infamous info dump that all of us, I am sure, are guilty of at some point in our writing career. And as a novice, you, mostly novices, I'm guessing, are really guilty of it, because when I was you, years ago, coming to Gen Con, I just wanted to write all this cool stuff about my world, because it's so cool. And in the editorial process, I cut out so much of it, and it was so painful, because it's like your little child, you know, and you created this idea, and it's just one paragraph, but it's the bad paragraph, where the person's brain just shuts right off. They don't care.
The person reads the story and goes, okay, I'll stop here, and puts it down.
Yeah, why is this important
right now?
So, like, one of the things that I learned, you know, writing my first novel, The Golden Cord, which, it's not even my first novel. It's things like the fifth novel, even though it's the first book, because I rewrote it, like, 5 times. But, you know, the first few times, I had to take out so many things because they weren't important at that moment. Did I save them? Did I maybe cut that paragraph out and just stick it in a file and go, okay, here's a description of blank. Yeah, okay. And then maybe later in the book when, you know, the certain kind of plant was wrapping around the character's throat and pulling him up into the tree to pull him into the center of the tree where he'd be slowly digested, maybe that's when that needs to be in there. You know, maybe that doesn't need to be on page 2. So, you know, you get my point.
How many people are gamers?
there's a softball.
I've been running games for 30 years, 30 plus years, since mid-70s. And when I first started, I'd spend hours writing about all this stuff, writing it down on paper, keeping track of everything, all the background stuff in case I needed it for a game. And then somewhere in the middle of that, I just decided, I don't need to write any of that down. Write down the skeleton, play the game, make something up as it goes along. It's the same sort of thing with setting. Throw in the setting as it comes along, not unassociated with the rest of the plot.
Yeah. And even for things like cities and such, you can achieve a lot with some fairly broad strokes. You know, if your characters have in your fantasy novel come across a city, and you describe the roofs of shingled with blue stone. Say, then your reader already has something in their head. You don't have to talk about, you know, how the streets are laid out. You can describe specific plazas with a fountain or a statue, or, you know, the fire sculptors working over at the edge of the market to do stuff for the amusement of the kids, or the temple where the naked priests cast benedictions naked priests. See, right there, you know, that's at least you.
You're going to read that page.
That's already started to tell you something about the society that they live in too. You know, you can achieve a lot just by showing details, and you don't have to get into the full, you know, the full Lonely Planet guide to Venus Tirith kind of thing.
There's two.
One really good detail is worth like 1,000 generalities. So that's what I learned in writing the Iron Dragon books, is I got to put in these details sparingly. You know, world building is so complex, and you literally will come up with 100 different things and then use 3 in the first few chapters. And it sucks.
But it's
so
not
bad.
It's not wasted for the second, third,
no,
third
that's right.
And then later when you're layering it and you're figuring out a little more, maybe, you know, some of those things come in. But maybe you can't put the 3 details in unless you know the other 97 details.
Yeah. And it's gonna and it will come through regardless to your reader in that sense. There's my third novel, which I'm working on now, is just about a religious assassin in a medieval fantasy city. Think Jason Bourne meets 16th century fantasy with magic. Okay, So one of the things that there's an area of the city in which he lives called Corel, and the area that he goes to is called the Church District, and it is simply dominated by a large rectangle of green lawn that extends well into the distance with churches all lining up at the end, and the religious order that he works for, the Order of Argoth, is in this massive cathedral, which you can see, because it's so huge, from the end of the district. And one of the things that I describe about that, which is important to the story, is the fact that he had always found, his life is in many ways very chaotic as an assassin, and he had always taken solace from the sort of orderly nature of the beauty of how it was always the same way, that stability, the churches were always there, standing guard next to each other as they overlooked this beautiful square of green. And it's in such contrast to the rest of his life, which requires him to adapt on the fly and adjust to circumstances, and he tries to plan, but, you know, things come up when you are trying to assassinate people, and he has to change his plans. And this, he always comes back in his mind to this place where he feels at peace and stable and secure. And as the book goes on, he finds himself being less stable and secure there because things that are happening in their district. That's part of the conflict within him. But the point is that aspect of setting is very important, and I have to take a little bit of time to describe it. What I don't have to describe is, and there where the grass had been cut in a particular way, and he could see, and there the stones that flagstone he had tripped over 60 times. You know, then you're getting into the source book stuff again. And so concentrating your efforts again on, you know, what serves, what he would be thinking of, what serves him, and how it will reflect on what the reader knows about that character. By finding this stuff out, that Greyshade pays attention to this area, that teaches you something about Greyshade. So setting is in service to him. And that's important to keep in mind when you're writing, you know.
I think it's time to throw it open to questions, so you've had your hand up for a while.
The question I have is, one thing is like in my critique last night, people were very big on what my setting was. In terms of, I had a town called Portsmouth, and we got Australia from one gentleman, New England and England is the obvious choices. Mm-hmm. And in New England, there's four or five of the Portsmouths. How much is it okay to rely on the fact that the cover of the book says this is an alternative Victorian story set in another universe that Earth people travel to, whereas trying to tell that in the first chapter?
I think New Portsmouth, and then you maybe you say something else, New Portsmouth, whatever, and that would give us some sort of clue. I don't think you
that's
can't...
That's not the original.
I don't know what you just said. What did you say?
That it's not the original Portsmouth.
It's not the original Portsmouth. And then, remember, when you send it in, there ain't no book cover. Okay? The editor's going to have maybe no clue. So you're going to have to convey something. Although if you have
it's
a query,
Victorian, if you describe the gas lights and the hiss of the gas going into them and the smells of the poor sanitation,
yep.
and the coal and the smog in the air and that sort of stuff. You know, you don't have to tell us everything about it, but if you just think of what you would notice. In the broad strokes of just looking around this town, and write it down. And as long as it doesn't go on for paragraphs and paragraphs, I think that's probably the right amount.
I feel Chris on that question. However, you're going to have a query letter, and maybe in your query letter, you're going to say this is an alternate universe, you know, Victorian blah. So they have that maybe, okay?
Yeah,
so given that
I figured there's something to cover the book, the query letter.
There's no cover to the book. Just
cover.
Throw that out.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't even worry about that.
Yeah.
Okay,
you got to sell it to the publisher.
We are far away from that.
Yeah.
Okay, you're really far away from that. All right, so forget that. All right, but don't do too much. Like what he said sounds kind of good, but don't do too much. But seriously, like that.
Kind of good job,
Chris.
Kind of good job.
Much.
Yeah.
He gave me like six or seven little details. All of a sudden, boom, boom, boom. Maybe that's not the right way to go.
Well, you can sew those through the chapter. Too.
Chapter.
So you don't have to
get
info dump.
Three pages did you read?
5 minutes, yeah.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying. Like those first three pages, maybe it's three details and not, you know, as many. Don't start it like, you know, Charles Dickens.
Yeah. Well, this, I think the other thing, way to answer that is, if it catches up, the people in the reading critique, if it bothered them that the setting was vague, then it probably indicates that there was some issue with it. It meant that they didn't have a good grasp of the world. Perhaps then it doesn't mean that you have to just deal with the setting itself. It may also be that if you had made other aspects of it more engaging and intriguing, they would have thought so, wouldn't have been as concerned that much about the setting per se. But I'm entirely in agreement with what Paul says in that you have to be careful. You can't rely on externals to do your job for you. For example, there are many, many cases where covers of books have nothing whatsoever to do with the book. There is a recent book that came out from an author whose name escapes me, and there's a dog on the cover. There's no dog in the book. There's dog. I swear to God, this is true. I'm not making this up. Now, there are dogs elsewhere in the series, so maybe they're like, you know, oh yeah, I remember. There's that thing with the dog. You know, maybe. But there's no dog in the book. And she is a published, long-time published author, and her reaction is like, what the hell is this? And the publisher's, and literally the publisher's answer was, your books with dogs on covers sell better. Just telling you. And this is why you don't kill off dogs in your books either, by the way. But anyway, so the point being that you cannot rely on externals. Like to get serious again, you can't rely on externals. You have to allow the writing to do its work for you. And therefore, if the setting is bothering them, then it either means that you need to give a little bit more emphasis, you need to change up the setting a bit, or you need to make sure that that's not the focus of the initial part of it. Maybe something else is the part of that opening story that will interest them, and then you can worry about developing setting later on. You won't be able to do that forever. You won't be able to just follow a character around in a vacuum forever, but you can sometimes put more emphasis on them in the beginning, and readers will go along with you so long as you then begin to add in aspects of the setting later on. So that should be to you a sort of a red flag that something's going on there. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do every. I must make my setting fully developed right now, but something is going on that's making them focus on that to the exclusion of something.
Read China Mie Bill.
Yeah.
For
you could just stop there. Just read China Mie.
Yeah. But he's so good at creating settings, at introducing you bit by bit into these ridiculous, fantastic cities. Every book.
And don't put it all at the beginning, because then they don't have to read the rest. They get the whole thing.
That's right.
China's a gamer, by the way.
Oh, it does. Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Big time gamer. It's like the most literary, crazy fantasy you've ever possibly read. But oh my god. I have a hard time with it, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, Charles Strauss is a gamer, too.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Do you have any recommendations for resource material on things around in our world that we don't have access to that might be a little more difficult to find? For example, we all know what a swamp is, we all know what a mountain is, but what does it look like when you approach those areas? What does the edge of that look like? I have no idea. If I have a character who is going into the jungle and it's near civilization, is it just chopped off? Does it, the jungle just start? You know, those kinds of questions that we wouldn't really know where to start.
I read National Geographic every month, and I've done that since, like, 1980 or something.
It's also available on DVD, too.
So, like, for me, like, they go on adventures and Adventure Magazine. There's a lot of wilderness-type stuff that you can read about, and you can get a feel, you can get a pretty good feel for it, but once again, you may have to experience some of these things, and then talking to people who've been to these places, you know, like, the writer who just writes that there's nothing in the desert, they've probably never been there.
No, I grew up
in Death Valley, like, near Death Valley, California, Nevada. There's so much crazy crap that's laying around on the ground, and you encounter all these weird things, and so there's
stuff.
Well,
there's also no such thing as the desert.
There was nothing for miles.
A barren wasteland.
Like 7 million bushes. Okay, there's anyway.
And there's no such thing as an impassable desert. It's just hard to get across.
Yeah,
some people say I can't get across that. To them, it's impassable, but to the person who knows the desert. It's like, we'll get you across, don't worry.
Quick book, The Secret Knowledge of Water. Like, we've kind of talked about water a little bit on this panel. Like, my God, water is the key component to human civilization and all life itself. So if you understand the water system, it all makes sense. Why is there a giant city in the middle of the desert and there's no water source? I think you screwed up.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example. You're walking across, and then the city rising from the how? How would it do this? And I think also the other point I want to make about this, which is very important, is I think that when you represent aspects of a world that people would at least have some sense of, they've heard of deserts, even if they don't know the details of them. I think it is your obligation as a writer, I firmly believe it's your obligation as a writer, not to be patronizing in your description of it. To say that there is nothing in a desert is to dismiss it as being that place I never go to. That's garbage. If you're going to actually write about this desert and have it mean something, then you can't just throw it in and blank, right? Because you're dismissing the creatures that live there in your world, the people that have carved out a way of life for themselves there, you dismiss them entirely to make it like, and all those in that crazy, barren, impassable place that I never go to. Just as one might say, think about what Maurice was saying at the beginning about, going under that bridge, I was fascinated by that, and looking up in those holes to find people that are living there. Are you going to dismiss that as, nobody lives out underneath the bridge, and, all that stuff where no one lives?
Everybody drives past and doesn't look.
And so what you're ultimately doing is being dismissive and a little patronizing about it, which beyond the fact that you should avoid that for yourself, it also means that you're not going to be as effective a writer in communicating what really matters to those people. You then can't take someone from this area that you've dismissed and say, here's this really powerful, meaningful character that has all this. How are you going to do that when you've dismissed this place they grew up and lived? And so it's important, I think, to be trying to be mindful of the fact that these environments, though you may not be familiar with them, have an ecology all their own. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, another way to sort of get source material that you mentioned before, is by using the travelogue. If you look at people who have written experiences about traveling to these places, particularly authors who are used to them, Herman Melville is a good example of this, who writes travelogues of places that he had actually been to. V.S. Naipaul is another one who does stuff like this. Now, they have their own interpretation of those places, so you can't take it as gospel.
There's a lot of modern ones too.
You can't take it as gospel because, again, they have their own sort of position from which they're approaching it. But that said, you can get some valuable insight into these places, and even better, they are the insights of a writer. And sometimes even better than that, they are sometimes the insights of a writer who hasn't been there, just like you. And two, if they're doing it carefully, are sort of exploring the world in the way you would hope you would explore the world and present it to your readers too. So,
what did that bridge smell like?
Yeah.
I wonder what Maurice found out. Asphalt and urine? I don't know.
Or sounded like?
Probably. You had to go there. You had to go there.
Right.
And sometimes it's around the corner.
Right.
Any other questions? I guess I got time for one more. Any closing comments? Oh, is there a question?
Well, I was just going to bring up when you guys talked about, and I beat a dead horse because I really love this series, Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn takes place in a world that has been totally altered from what it is, but he's really good about not saying things that the characters wouldn't say. Mm-hmm. Like a little tiny thing is that all the plants in his world are brown. But I didn't find that out for like 150 pages. And the way you find it out is when one of the characters who studied the past says, did you know plants used to be green?
Right.
And I'm like, what the hell?
What do you mean they used to be
green? Yeah.
Where did that happen? And he's got these volcanoes and they have these ash falls and all this stuff is going down. But it's so normal to the characters that they don't really talk about it that much. The whole thing really kind of unfolded. I thought it was really, really good.
The first page of Mistborn, there's ash falling, and it's like covering everything, and like nobody's it's not even part of their worry at all. And I'm thinking, holy shit, run away! The volcano's gonna blow.
I've seen this before.
Yeah,
I mean, he also has. I mean, the other thing that Sanderson does is because he's such a good writer, he has the art to reveal this stuff in such a way that you don't feel annoyed when you find out that detail. So it's not as if you're sort of jarred out of what you imagined. You've sort of gone along, you've started to fill in aspects of the world, you've started to fill in things, but you don't feel like, how dare you do that to me? Because he's revealed it at the right pace. And a lot of this is about pacing and when you reveal aspects of the setting and how much and at what time. And the number one thing I think that amateur writers do that everyone has to get over is they rush. They want everything to come now. They want the setting now, the character now, everything now. And it's not necessary. You need to take time. Even in the most sort of hard-boiled thrillers where you're, or detective novels or thrillers where everything's like a page a minute, even then, you need to develop things over time. I've used the Bourne Identity series before because I love those series of movies. And the Bourne series, and even Ludlum's books as well, allow you to develop an understanding of the world and Jason Bourne himself over time. They don't rush. And it's the same thing with setting. What Sanderson does so well is he doesn't rush. He reveals it at a pace that you feel comfortable with.
And settings are characters.
Yes.
You don't
tell everything about the character at the beginning of the book. You reveal stuff as it goes along.
Same deal.
Just like you were saying. They talk about it when it happens versus all up front. They don't say, okay, everything's brown. This is this. We've got ash falling all the time. We don't notice it anymore.
Yeah.
It's a character, and characters get revealed through the story. The settings get revealed through the story, too.
Yep.
I wrote a bio of my world, my Medusa's Daughter's novel, which is it's a love story set in ancient Greece, and it mostly takes place on this island that's just fairly destroyed by volcanic activity. Or it was destroyed. And the island is a pissed-off place. It is not happy. It does not like people walking around on it. And the island is a character in the book, and I don't mean that it doesn't talk. It's not sentient, but to me, it's a character. And writing that bio on it was really, really cool. In Mistborn, a Brandon Sanderson series, it's Middle Earth, and Sauron's one, and the Dark Lord has dominion over everything, and it's a fascinating setting. He doesn't say that, but that's how the book is sort of pitched. You know, and if you come up with a really cool setting, it's going to add so much to your novel. And let the details evolve naturally. Don't force them in there, which I did, and continue to do in first drafts. You know, just let them evolve naturally.
You have more time than you think.
And I think we're sort of out of time. Yeah,
we don't have more time.
Come and talk to us. You know, we have Pick Your Brain sessions. I have one tomorrow at 11.
I have one in a couple hours if you want to do that.
Book signing today at 2 for me. Come by, talk, we'll hang out, we'll talk more about this.
Yeah, I have one at 3, so.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you guys for coming.
And tickets, if you haven't brought them, please bring them up. Thanks.